This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 16th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we talked to a Fayetteville resident whose grandson was killed in the Sandy Hook shooting a year ago. Plus, we learn more about healing ministries at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Also, the Red Cross is trying to catch up after having to cancel blood drives during a winter storm that recently hit the state. Johnny Cash is the subject of the latest installment of Arkansongs and more. But first, Governor Mike Beebe has declared 22 counties across the state disaster areas because of the damage caused by the recent ice and snow. Though the ice has mostly receded, areas across the state are still dealing with the storm's aftermath. Matt DeCampbell, the governor's spokesperson, says state and federal officials are working with the counties to determine whether they qualify for federal funding.
We should know by next week whether or not we meet the threshold to have the governor make the request to Washington, D.C. to get some federal assistance. And if we see that federal assistance, it's going to be what's called public assistance, which helps restore and repair infrastructure in those counties, and especially what we saw with some of the smaller rural electric cooperatives during the storm.
DeCampbell says crews from FEMA and the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management are surveying the areas affected by the winter storms.
And those assessment teams are going to go around, they're in about half the counties already, and try to figure out whether or not Arkansas will qualify for some federal assistance.
He says once the amount of federal funding is determined, how to source the rest of the money will be addressed. The state's Legislative Audit Committee has found that Lieutenant Governor Mark Dar misspent thousands of dollars in office funds for personal or undocumented expenses. The annual audit report, released late last week, found that Dar misspent more than $12,000 using state credit cards, unauthorized travel reimbursements, and more. The report concluded that Dar should pay nearly $10,000 back to the office. First Security Bank Corp. of Little Rock has a new president for its Northwest Arkansas market. Adam Rutledge was named CEO and president for Northwest Arkansas late last week. Rutledge has previously served as senior vice president and commercial lender of the Northwest Arkansas market, and according to the bank, he has played an integral role in the growth of the market. He is a board member for LifeSource International and is also on the Walton College of Business Alumni Society board. Rutledge replaces Jim Taylor as president for Northwest Arkansas. Taylor will continue with the company as senior vice president of the bank's Little Rock parent company. Walmart Stores has named another new head for one of the retail giant's regional divisions. According to the City Wire, the company has named Krish Iyer as the new president and CEO of its Indian division. Iyer officially takes the position January 20th, replacing Ramnik Narsi, who has filled the position on an interim basis since June. Iyer joined Walmart International in 2012 as a senior vice president. The leadership change comes after Walmart announced in October it would dissolve its joint venture with Bharti Enterprises in the country, a partnership that was marked by an internal investigation late last year into bribery allegations in India. The city of Fayetteville will host a public input session tomorrow regarding restoration plans for two historic bridges in the downtown area. The city has been developing plans to restore the historic bridges on Lafayette and Maple Streets, and according to the city, those plans are about a third of the way complete. The input session is scheduled from 4 to 6 p.m. tomorrow at the City Administration Building. The Works Progress Administration originally built the two historic bridges in the 1930s, and they are the only two pieces of city property on the National Register of Historic Places. Funding for the restoration work is being covered by $1 million from the Federal Highway Bridge Replacement and Rehabilitation Program. The remaining $1.4 million estimated cost is being covered by money from the city's transportation bond program. A new exhibit looking at the history and design of the Bowie knife is being hosted by the Historic Arkansas Museum in downtown Little Rock. The collection, which features items owned by President Theodore Roosevelt and Alamo hero Davy Crockett, opened Friday. Bill Worthen, the museum's director, says the wide variety of knives makes for a compelling retrospective.
It is really the most comprehensive look at the Bowie knife ever assembled. And so you go everywhere from the earliest of the Bowie knives all the way to late ones. It's a history lesson of the entirety of the spectrum of Bowie knives in one place.
The collection will be on display at the museum through June of next year. Mostly clear tonight with lows from 26 in northwest Arkansas to 34 in the Arkansas River Valley. Sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid to upper 50s. And tomorrow night, expect mostly clear conditions with lows from 31 in northwest Arkansas to 38 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. The Red Cross is trying to make up for some lost ground. This month's winter storm wiped out dozens of blood drives across Arkansas. Marcy Manley, a Red Cross spokesperson, recently told Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums that blood donations are already low during the months of November, December, and January because of busy holiday schedules.
The supply is sufficient right now. We're meeting patient needs, but we have to constantly replenish that supply because roughly every 2 seconds someone needs blood.
It sounds kind of like a household budget, that you know you've got to have so much, and then if something happens, you don't have as much as you were hoping you'd have.
Exactly. You don't want to spend down to having a dollar left and then have your transmission go out and not have anything there and ready to go. So the blood on the shelves today is what's going to help someone today, but we have to be ready for the emergency situations that might happen tomorrow and on down the line. When you give your blood donation, it goes into that bag and then it has to go through testing. We want to make sure that that blood is safe. So that's about a 3-day delay. So a lot of people will give in the case of an emergency. They hear about a national emergency or a worldwide emergency disaster that happens and they want to help, and we completely appreciate that. But we can't take that blood donation that you give today and send it to someone today. It has to go through those safety precautions. So we want to make sure that we have a supply in stock that can be there for those emergency situations and still have some coming in to be ready for those everyday needs.
Okay, you've lost dozens, almost 40 of these blood drives, and you turn the corner and we're not too far from the holidays. Can you make that up?
We rely on people to be willing to come through the doors to make it up. You know, the donors who decide to come through will decide whether we're able to get the donations in that we had hoped for. Making up 1,000 donations in 2 weeks' time, I mean, we're, you know, projecting for the month. We have a budget, if you will, of mm-hmm. what we really need to collect each month. Getting those 1,000 donations made up, there are opportunities to give. There are a number of donation opportunities, particularly in northwest Arkansas, over the next 2 weeks. We hope people will take advantage of that.
Yeah, they're at Walmarts, they're at high schools, they're all over the place. I take it that's the key, making it as easy as possible for people to just kind of drive or walk up.
Absolutely. We are more than welcoming to walk-ins. We also want to make it easy for people if they have a time frame that they want to give in. The donation process from the time you walk into the door to the time you walk out with your free cookies takes about an hour for the average person. So if people want to block out that hour, they can make a donation appointment. And so if you have an 8 o'clock appointment and you get there and there are walk-ins that have come in, you get sort of bumped to the front of the line. We want to take care of you because you have budgeted that time. So, yeah, I mean, we try to make it as easy as possible. If we only had one blood drive a week, you know, everybody has schedules that are crazy and they're hectic. We know that doesn't work for people. That's why we want to give as many opportunities in as many places as possible.
I don't mean to be flippant about this, but it sounds a little bit like trying to attract people to give money to public radio, in that you've got to make them think about it. You tell them, and I'm not suggesting that public radio is more important than a blood drive. I'm not saying that. But you sometimes have to attract these first-time donors. And some people can be hesitant, you know, to give blood the first time. So walk us through what happens that first time.
People are very hesitant. The top two reasons that we hear that people don't give blood is that they've never been asked. So I'm asking right now that
so
you,
if you
give
hear
blood.
This.
Yes, please do. The second is they're afraid of needles. No one likes needles. I don't know anyone that says, I think I'd like to have a needle in my arm today. But I think it's weighing the pros and cons of it. Most donors, even those who are really afraid, I've stood by people who were really afraid of donating, but they did it because they're thinking, my one donation can help save three lives. And what if those three lives are my mother, my sister, my brother, who may need these at some point? Once they actually do it, they describe it as a pinch in the arm, and in 10 minutes, it's done. And the worrying about it was a lot worse for them. So basically, that's how people describe it, a pinch in the arm, that one thing that you're really afraid of. The donation process works in that you walk in the door, you'll do some required reading that informs you about eligibility, medications that maybe preclude you from giving, travel to some areas is restricted because of different illnesses that are prevalent there. Then you'll go through a mini physical where your temperature will be taken, your hemoglobin levels will be checked to make sure your iron is high enough for you to give safely, and then you go through and do the donation. Time in the chair, usually for the average person, about 10 minutes.
Take a newspaper, take your iPad, you're golden.
We allow all of that. I mean, if you want to read your John Grisham novel, if you want to play Angry Birds with the free hand, you know, do what works for you. We understand. You don't have to just sit there and think about, well, I'm miserable for these 10 minutes. I mean, and most people don't. You'll right. find that a lot of people use blood drives as a social event, too. I mean, you get to see people, meet people, and you'd be surprised with how many people have a story, whether they realize it or not. Where their life has a tie to someone who needed blood or where blood donation made a difference.
Marcy Manley is a Red Cross spokesperson. To find out more about blood drives in the region, you can go to redcrossblood.org. More moves at Walmart and a lot of moves in the banking industry. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has the details in his weekly recap of the state's biggest business headlines.
David Cheesewright has been appointed CEO of the International Division of Walmart Stores effective February 1st. Cheesewright will succeed CEO-elect Doug McMillan, who was named to his new post as CEO of Walmart last week. Since September of 2011, Cheesewright has served as head of a regional management team responsible for Walmart's operations in Canada, the United Kingdom, and Africa. Tommy May is set to step down from his post as chairman and CEO of Simmons First National on January 1st. CEO-elect George Makris will assume the top post after a year-long transition. May will become the inaugural chairman of the Simmons First Foundation, a charitable giving extension of the bank that will distribute Tommy May Make a Difference grants to local community projects. Bank of the Ozarks has entered into an agreement to acquire BankShares, Inc. of Houston, Texas. Under terms of the agreement, Bank of the Ozarks will pay $23 million for all outstanding shares of BankShares common stock. The transaction is expected to close during the first quarter of 2014. A bank deal announced in October has closed. Arvest Bank announced its acquisition of National Bank of Arkansas has been completed. The conversion of NBA accounts and operations into Arvest will not be finished until early February. Terms of that transaction were not disclosed. The Walton Family Foundation announced a $2.1 million grant to the University of Arkansas to fund several programs within the College Access Initiative and the Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education. The funds will directly benefit students from Phillips County, Arkansas, and those who have graduated from public charter schools around the state. As part of the program, university officials will expand ACT training for high school students and will also increase recruiting efforts at certain schools. On the jobs front, Ben E. Keith Company announced it will build a $60 million, 350,000-square-foot distribution center in North Little Rock by 2016. The food service distributor will add 80 new jobs to its state workforce of 275 after the expansion is completed. And telecom provider AT&T said it presently is hiring 50 workers for open positions in Arkansas, including 30 new jobs. Nabholz Construction announced that CEO Bill Hanna has been named chairman of the board, and Chief Financial Officer Greg Williams will step into the role of Chief Executive Officer on January 1st. Williams has served as CFO for Nabholz for the past 18 years. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com.
KUAF says thank you to the many contributing listeners who called in or went online to help us out during our end-of-year fundraiser. You helped us raise over $64,000. Your public radio station will only remain strong if your commitment to it is strong. Thanks again. And if you didn't get a chance to give, you can go to supportkuaf.com and pledge your support now. It's fast, easy, and secure. And again, thank you to our contributing listeners.
It is Monday, December 16th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoine Ecker-Hayda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
How much shopping do you have left, my friend?
Just one person to shop for.
Are you kidding?
No, I did the majority of it like right after Thanksgiving. I just wanted it done because it's one of those things that you're like, yeah, I have all these great ideas. I'm going to go do this. And then life gets busy and then you realize it's Christmas Eve and you have nothing.
Oh, I used to finish at the War Eagle Craft Fair.
Yeah. No,
well, not anymore. We're hoping.
You're hoping?
We're hoping that Christmas is not delayed.
It's the thought that counts and all of that, right?
I'm still looking for the Christmas spirit.
Okay.
As I was over the weekend. So here are some more ways to try to find some.
Okay.
6 o'clock tonight, the Platters are grand marshals of the Parade of Lights Christmas Parade in Eureka Springs.
Are they up in Branson now?
I think so.
Right, yeah.
And they're, of course, the name does not mean the original. Lots of the original performers are gone. But it means a promise to that style. So it'll be fun. And Holiday Harmonies with the Arkansas Winds Community Concert Band. It's the first concert of their Silver Jubilee season.
Oh.
At 7:30 at Central United Methodist Church in Fayetteville. And it is free.
All right. Lots of things to do. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Healing Touch, an international healing program, is a biofield therapy, meaning it deals with the magnetic field around the body, to promote a variety of areas of healing. The Healing Touch Ministry at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville began in the late 1990s in an effort to bring spiritual healing away from the physical location of the church and into the ill's home or to a hospice. The ministry now has its own location and has at least 10 practitioners who give upward of 600 sessions a year. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas recently visited the ministry to receive a healing touch treatment and has this report.
A short climb up Mount Sequoia and up a driveway that begins between two large pines will take you to a house. This house once belonged to the late Eva Stalker. As you park your car and walk into the screened-in sitting room that overlooks the hills of East Fayetteville, you'll walk past a wooden sign, engraved with the Stalkers. Eva Stalker had no children, and her extended family was limited. So her will stated that the home should go to St. Paul's Episcopal Church and another area church. Jane Steinkraus is a parishioner at St. Paul's.
She particularly wanted it to be used for healing, which was something that she sought for many years towards the end of her life, and also for music ministry. And it's just a really beautiful place. I mean, I think it is. I think the view, I think the quiet, it's always quiet up here. I think that is a part of what makes it a healing place.
The home is now the location for St. Paul's Healing Touch Ministries. Healing Touch is an energy therapy in which practitioners consciously use their hands in a heart-centered and intentional way to support and facilitate mental, spiritual, physical, and emotional health and healing. The touch is lighter than massage, and often practitioners' hands don't even touch the client's body, but rather hover over it. Using a special series, the intent is to balance the body's energy, whatever part of them is out of equilibrium. Clients have a variety of issues, some with physical ailments, others mental or emotional.
Because people come in for all kinds of reasons, for grief, the loss of a loved one, chronic pain, multiple sclerosis, you name it, we see it.
Some clients come in for something as basic as a sprained ankle or as serious as cancer. The first just coming in for maybe a session or two. The second every week for years on end. The touch uses chakras and is similar to Reiki treatments. Though some say they do work miracles, healing touch is not, however, the evangelical miracle healing you often see on TV. Healing Touch is an internationally accredited program that was started by a nurse and originally taught only two nurses. Now it's open to anyone willing to learn. Holly Aaron is a massage therapist and St. Paul's Healing Touch Ministries coordinator. She explains that the training is a series of five workshops and takes years of dedication.
There are five levels. There's Healing Touch 1, 2, 3, and 4. 4 is in preparation to become a practitioner. So you're a student from 1 through 3. And then 4, you actually become a practitioner apprentice. And then between level 4 and 5, there's quite a lot of homework, including 100 documented sessions and book reviews, receiving other energetic modalities as comparison, and mentorship. And then at the end of that year, you can become a practitioner at Healing Touch Level 5. And then following that, you're ready for to submit for certification. And then you'd be certified by the Healing Touch program.
The 10 or so volunteer practitioners with St. Paul's vary in level of training, but all come from a field of healing. Some are physical therapists or counselors. Jane is a former nurse and nurse midwife. Drawing on both Eastern and Western medical traditions, doctors often refer patients to the Healing Touch Ministries, either to work in conjunction with their medical treatments or as a last resort. Further helping Jane's practice as a practitioner is the fact that she herself received treatments when she had a serious illness a few years back.
You know, I was really grateful when I got better, and but I feel like I can understand people who are going through illnesses a whole lot better than I could when I'd always been well. You know, you have a different, really visceral level, connection with them at that point.
Sessions last about an hour and require the practitioner to be grounded, centered, and attuned to the client, and require some prep, says Holly.
Grounding would be connecting to the earth energy and to the universal energy field and allowing that to connect through you. At the point that you do that, you will usually feel your hands light up, and so you'll feel the energy in your hands. Centering is to kind of bring your energy and scattered thoughts all, bring them all home, bring them to, you know, where you are focused and centered and ready to only be present for your client. And then attuning is where you will connect with the client's energy field. And so that can be done by touch or by just entering their field with intention to attune to them.
I did receive a session from Holly and Jane. Sometimes they work together on one client, but not always. As I walked through the doorway into what was once a living room, but now holds three massage tables, the journalist in me wanted to record my session. The stressed out, frazzled, tired woman in me wanted to enjoy whatever was in store. Holly and Jane convinced this tired gal to enjoy. I took off my shoes and climbed under a blanket atop one of the tables, as Holly, too, removed her shoes and turned on some easy music. I closed my eyes as they began with the prayer. Healing Touch is spiritual in nature, and as it is a ministry of St. Paul's, sessions do begin in prayer. But as clients do not have to be members of the church, practitioners are sensitive to spiritual beliefs.
For a lot of us, we do feel like prayer is a part of it, and that doesn't necessarily mean specifically Christian prayer, but just being really open to, I mean, I'd probably say the work of the Holy Spirit, but you could also say, you know, just healing energies.
Right. And in the intake process, there is a question, and the question is, what words do you use for higher power? So that then it's in the client's words of whatever they use for higher power. So it's not, you know, not specific to anyone. And that's in the intake for the healing touch when it's removed from St. Paul's.
I was so relaxed after my session, returning to the KUAF studios a completely different person than when I had left. David Wright has experienced a similar feeling. He's just been receiving Healing Touch for 4 weeks and tried it at the recommendation of his friend, Jane Steinkraus, whom he had called because of his incredibly high stress level.
Don't ask me how to explain how it works. I just know it does, and it has helped me so much in a number of ways, stress-wise, clarity in my head, and with freedom of movement of my shoulders and my jaw.
He says that when he first gets onto the table, he tries to focus on his breath and clear his mind of stress and be open to receive. It is energy healing, and David says that he can feel the energy, even when their hands are not on his body.
My eyes were closed, but I knew exactly, two people were working on me, and I knew exactly where their hands were at all times. Now, that's the energy that was exchanged. And, I can't, it's hard to explain, but I could tell where they were at every moment.
It's a sensation that remains long after he returns home, a feeling he likens to icy hot. Warm, yet chilling. Bud Planchin is a cancer patient. He has had numerous surgeries, going into remission 3 times, yet it has returned again. He began Healing Touch after making a promise to a dear friend who was in hospice care. With a background in emergency medical services, he had a linear way of thinking when it came to his treatments, and was skeptical at first, but quickly became a believer when he left so relaxed. He can't put it into qualitative terms, but says Healing Touch forces him to do an hour of meditation each week and helps him sleep so much better that night.
There's times I go in there and I am frazzled because my regular day for chemo is on a Wednesday. And so, I mean, and by Friday I'm so tired and everything, but I can't sleep because of the medication and stuff, and I'll just fall asleep, boom. And it's a wonderful feeling to be able to relax and not think about the illness.
In addition to sleeping better and the mental healing, it lessens Bud's pain.
I've had several surgeries, and because of the surgeries and the locations of the surgeries, I have a lot of adhesions and scar tissue, and sometimes they really become painful, and it does release a lot of that pain sometimes. And, it helps a lot.
Whether stress or cancer, Jane is confident in the positive effects of Healing Touch.
And we see it all the time. We see people come in, very stressed, very anxious, not able to sleep, with pain, whatever, and leave saying things like, I haven't felt this relaxed in months. At some point, the pain just went away. I slept well, they'll come back, I slept well this week.
The Healing Touch Ministries of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville is a free service to anyone in the community, and all practitioners are volunteers. For more information, visit stpaulsfay.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Saturday morning was a busy one for St. Paul's Episcopal Church. While some folks were preparing for the Fayetteville Farmers Market Winter Market, a small group gathered on the west side of the building to watch David Lewis ring the church's bell. The Fayetteville resident rang the bell for about 5 minutes to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. 6 adults and 20 children died in the Connecticut shooting, including David's grandson, Jesse. Jesse is survived by several family members, including his older brother, JT, and his mother, Scarlett. Last Friday, David stopped by Studio 123 to discuss the foundation his daughter, Scarlett, has created in honor of her son. David began the conversation by discussing the bell ringing ceremony at St. Paul's.
I have a history with that church. I grew up in Fayetteville and went to that church as a young kid. And I can remember that it was a thrill to me as a six-year-old to be able to ring the bell. And I got to ring the bell occasionally. That may have been an incentive to get me to go to church. But as a six-year-old, the bell was so heavy it would actually pull me off the ground. If I remember correctly, this was a few years ago.
Well, those things can be very large, and I'm sure it did, in fact, pull you out the ground.
It is large. So I'll find out how large it is by ringing it tomorrow.
What were the conversations like for you when you were approached about doing this, as you have your own personal connection to the event versus just a citizen who, you know,
well,
parishioner who wanted to ring the bell?
You know, it's been a long, it's hard to believe a year's gone by, but it's been from tomorrow's date last year began a very difficult time in all of our lives. So ringing the bell is certainly more special to me than it would be to somebody else, because I was very close to it, very touched by it, and went through the whole process of watching the city of Newtown bury their 26 people over the course of about a week, and it was a pretty rough time for sure. But my daughter has come out of it. She started the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation, which is really about teaching kids about wisdom, about how to be happy, about being grateful, about how to choose love over anger, about things that I don't think are really taught in most schools today, to make it a better place, to make it a more peaceful place. And that was her wish, to honor her son, and it's been her salvation, I think, to go someplace other than anger and resentment over the fact that her son was killed. So she's been able to rise above it by really working at being grateful, and choosing love over anger.
What kind of conversations did you and your daughter Scarlett have about the foundation? Did she talk to you at all about her decision to start the foundation?
I really told her that's what she should do with the rest of her life, and we talked about it. And of course, she at the time had a lot of misgivings about everything, you know. And she was due to go back to work. I said, "No, you've got to pursue this. This is something you can do that'll be a life's work that will make the world a better place." And she's taken it and so far funded it and moved in that direction, and she's been motivated. She says she's been pushed by Jesse's spirit to do these positive things, and I think that's very true. I think that's true.
Well, it was sort of your idea, I guess, because you told her this is something she should do. So have you been able to help her in the process of creating the nonprofit organization?
Well, it was a process to get the 501c3 and form a board and to create some kind of organization. It doesn't really happen overnight. But we have a board. We have a 501c3. We've had several fundraisers in Connecticut. And, of course, she's written a book called Nurturing Healing Love. All the proceeds of that will be donated to the foundation, including some of the profits from Hay House will be also donated to the foundation. So that's going to be a funding source as well.
What is Hay House?
Hay House is what some people call it, a New Age publisher. But you've probably heard of Wayne Dyer or people like that, or Eckhart Tolle, I don't think, is produced by Hay House. But they produced a lot of inspirational type stuff, and it was founded by a lady who's now about 85, who's a very dynamic person who really started with nothing and built Hay House around a positive message, you know, the message of gratitude, the message of love, the message that Scarlett is trying to carry.
So with the foundation, how do you reach out to others? How do you teach that message of love? You guys are trying to do it through educational programs in schools?
Well, that's what we would like to do. And the exact plan is uncertain as how best to reach kids. I mean, we could produce, and we have produced, a video about survivors of the Rwandan genocide, which is an interesting story, because during the first week after the tragedy, we got in touch by Skype with some Rwandan genocide victims who wanted to express their condolences and love to particularly JT, who was 13 years old, and to Scarlett. So these people are 21, 22 years old. The genocide was in 1994. And they told their stories through an interpreter of what they had been through, and that forgiveness and love had led them to a happy place. And they had the most wonderful, gentle smiles on their face. And their stories were absolutely horrific. I mean, they were, you know, all their family was killed, and they were the only one there as a five-year-old to make their way in the world. So it was inspirational at the time to Scarlett and JT, because it would be easy to fall into your own trap of the world's been unkind to me, and, you know, and I'm angry about it. But here, I mean, you couldn't imagine a worse story, and these kids had risen above it. So it was really a great thing to do. And we're doing a little documentary on this effort in Rwanda, hoping that we can create a curriculum around it and show it to schools where, you know, really there are a lot of lessons in this, but certainly a lesson is in gratitude. You know, it's certainly a lesson in love and a lesson in forgiveness. And simple wisdom that these kind of examples, I think, can bring the world, that can't help but be positive for our young kids. And that's, we hope to do that in several different ways, maybe by using also modern ways to communicate with an eighth grader, you know, which may not necessarily be a video. It may be through a lot of other new type means of media conversations where they can actually interact. And so this is kind of an ongoing, how do we do this kind of deal. And the educational system, of course, is pretty well set in the way they think they should do things. So you're not going to go in and turn the world upside down overnight. But if you could do it from the ground up or from the grassroots up, that would really be neat. So that's the effort. That's the challenge.
Well, it's a good challenge. And the Rwandans who reached out to you, have you guys been able to reach out to others in your effort with this Choose Love movement?
Well, the Rwanda thing came about because of a lady who is now on the board of the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation, who'd been in Rwanda and had championed these kids. And they're not kids anymore. They're 18 or 19, or the youngest ones are probably 18 or 19. And she has an effort to try to educate these kids. So JT got involved in trying to raise money for one of the girls to go to college. And it cost $1,800 a year to send a Rwandan to college. And then in this case, because she was supporting the family, we had to have another $200. So he raised enough to send this lady to 4 years of college from his efforts to raise funds for them. So it was kind of a cross current that, you know, kind of a good thing that happened. It also helped move him from a bad place to a good place. So that was a wonderful thing that came out of that.
Like you said, it's a bit of a challenge. Is it particularly more challenging trying to do something that's, say, a change in attitude as opposed to a change in legislation? Because I know something that came out of this was folks talking about, you know, gun legislation one way or the other. And here you're coming up with this concept of not being angry, you know, and choosing love instead of being angry and forgiveness and things like that. Is it a little more, I guess, difficult to explain that to someone, that that's your goal, and then maybe even changing people's minds?
A little bit, but, you know, let's think about it for a second. A symptom of the illness is using drugs, is being in jail, is shooting somebody else. And how do you treat the illness? You go back and teach love. If you really want to solve these problems, you got to start at the source of the illness, and that's anger, and the child is not based in love. And so I wish that I had, at 12 years old or 14 years old, somebody had told me, you don't have to be angry. You know, you don't have to carry anger around. Hey, it's a toxic mix. It's not a fun thing to do. So I think tell kids that. Tell them they don't have to be victims of the world, because victims of the world fill our prisons. So they have an alternative. They can be personally responsible. And going that route creates their own personal peace. Simple message, but I'm not sure how many times it's given. You know, it's just simply the truth. Now, can you prove it like 2 + 2 = 4? Maybe not, but it's common sense.
Can you tell me a little bit about your daughter's book? I understand the title was inspired by something that your grandson actually wrote.
He did. She lives in a little farmhouse in Sandy Hook. I think the farmhouse was built in about, I think, 1750. It's been added on to. But anyway, there's a wall in the kitchen that's actually a chalkboard. And after the tragedy, Scarlett lived with her mother for 2 weeks before she ever even went back into the house. And when she did go back into the house, she found on this chalkboard a message that Jesse had written in six-year-old spelling and basically six-year-old looking letters. It said, "Nurturing, healing, love." It was just there. She'd never seen it before. So it was just, she just took it as a message. And so she sent me out to get a piece of plexiglass, which we now put up over that message so that it'll always be there. But that on the cover of the book is a basically a picture of his handwriting, Nurturing, Healing, Love. And that's where the title of the book came from. But the book is about her experience from day one until we had a birthday party for Jesse in June. So obviously he wasn't there, but so it's that 7 month period of time in her life and how she was able to get through the worst nightmare, waking up and life's good and taking your son to school, to finding out not until 4 or 5 in the afternoon that he wasn't going to make it, you know, that he was dead, to a year, well, to 6 months later in the book. How, you know, just so many people said to her, I couldn't do that. And she, I couldn't stand the loss of a six-year-old child. And she said, well, yeah, you could. You just don't know it. You know, I mean, yeah, I've got to survive. I mean, it's very difficult. And I can see how you'd feel that way. But it's learning to accept what's real. I mean, that's one of our biggest challenges in life, accepting whatever comes to us, you know, even though it's difficult.
What do you hope that someone would take away from a memorial sort of thing, sort of like the ringing you guys are doing at St. Paul's or something like that? Because I know what it means for you, but what does it mean for, you know?
Well, I have these little bracelets, and on them, it says, "Choose love." Mm-hmm. And my daughter at the funeral. Now, this is a week after her son had been killed. I was going to read this to you because I'm going to read it at church tomorrow. Her message at her son's funeral was to all of us, and this is, if there's something to take away from it, it's this. She said, "If a lot of you've asked me what you can do for me, and I'm going to tell you what you can do for me. You can change one angry thought to a loving one every day. If we do this, we can change the world, and an event like this will be far less likely to occur." So she's asking you to take away and make an effort to. You may have to wear a little bracelet that says "Choose love." But when you want to get angry, just think about that, you know, choose love over anger. You'll be happier and you'll make the world a better place. So that's really the message from all of this that we want to promote as a way to change, as a way to treat the illness at its source.
That was David Lewis, Inside Studio 123, Friday afternoon. You can find out more about his daughter's organization at jessielewischooselove.org.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkin Songs.
Praises sing to Christ the King, and peace to men on earth.
On Christmas Eve, I dreamed I traveled all around the earth. And in my dream, I saw and heard the ways the different people hailed the King, whose star shone in the east. And what a dream it was.
Johnny Cash was born J.R. Cash, February 26, 1932, in Kingsland in Cleveland County in South Arkansas, and grew up in Dyess in Mississippi County in northeast Arkansas. Though he first made his name for himself in 1955 on Sun Records in Memphis, Tennessee, Cash's move to Columbia Records in mid-1958 saw him musically branching out to concept albums, gospel, folk, protest, even Christmas music. Cash's song, The Christmas Spirit, heard here from the album of the same name, was released in 1963.
In a little town nestled down in Bavarian Germany, I walked along to see what the feeling there would be. And here again was the busy din, the rushing, the yelling. But some kind voice said, Fröhliche Weihnachten, not understanding the words, but forgetting the buying and selling. I felt the Christmas spirit. I said the donkey, shaggy and brown, I carried his mother up and down. I carried his mother to Bethlehem town. I said the donkey, shaggy and brown.
Here's another Cash-written Christmas song called The Gifts They Gave from the same 1963 album, Johnny Cash's first Christmas album, for which he wrote four songs.
I set the dove from the rafters high. I sang him to sleep that he would not cry. We sang him to sleep, my love and I. I set the dove from the rafters high.
Nearly a decade later, Johnny Cash released the Johnny Cash Family Christmas, with less contributions from Cash himself and more from his musical family, including June Carter Cash. Nearly a decade after that, in 1980, Johnny Cash recorded an album of Christmas classics such as Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Joy to the World, Silent Night, Away in a Manger, and O Come, All Ye Faithful.
O come, all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. O come ye, O come ye to Bethlehem. Come and behold him, born the King of angels. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Christ the Lord.
Christmas as I Knew It, co-written by June Carter Cash, is one of the most interesting of Cash's holiday-themed songs and appears on a couple of his Christmas albums. The following version was recorded at Nashville, Tennessee's Ryman Auditorium during rehearsals for TV's The Johnny Cash Show in late 1970, but not released until 2003.
A poor old ragged lady eased open the door. She picked up the coal oil and hickory nuts and said, I sure do thank you, and quickly closed the door. We started back home then, Jack and me.
Johnny Cash recorded a second album of all traditional Christmas songs in 1991 on the Delta record label called Johnny Cash Country Christmas. In total, Cash recorded four holiday-themed albums, part of his wide-ranging musical catalog. Johnny Cash died September 12, 2003, following a half-century of music, his Christmas music being but one facet of the long and often varied career of South Arkansas-born, Northeast Arkansas-raised Johnny Cash. Here in its entirety is Johnny Cash with Christmas As I Knew It, co-written by June Carter Cash and recorded at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee, during rehearsals for Johnny Cash's TV show in late 1970.
One day near Christmas, when I was just a child, Mama called us together. Mama tried to smile. She said, you know, the cotton crop hadn't been too good this year. There's not a lot of spending money, but at least we're all here. I hope you won't expect a lot of Christmas presents. Just be thankful that there's plenty to eat.
That'll make things a little more pleasant. And us kids got to thinking how really blessed we were. At least we were all healthy. And most of all, we had her. Roy cut down a pin oak tree and we drug it home, Jack and me. Daddy killed a squirrel and Louise made the bread. Reba decorated the tree with popcorn strings before we went to bed. Yeah, Mom and Daddy sacrificed because this Christmas was kind of lean. After all, there was the babies, Tom and Joanne. And babies got to have a few things. I whittled a whistle for my brother Jack. And though we disagreed now and then, when I gave Jack that whistle, he knew I thought the world of him. Mama made the girls' dresses out of flour sacks, and when she ironed them down, you couldn't tell that they hadn't come from town. A sharecropper family across the road didn't have it as good as us. They didn't have a light in their house, and it was way past dusk. And Mama said, well, I bet they don't even have coal oil, let alone apples and oranges and such. Me and Jack took a jar of coal oil and some hickory nuts we had found and walked over to the sharecropper's porch and set them down. A poor old ragged lady eased open the door. She picked up the coal oil and hickory nuts and said, I sure do thank you, and quickly closed the door. We started back home then, Jack and me. About halfway back, we looked, and in the sharecropper's window, at last was a light. So for one of the neighbors and for us, it was a good Christmas night. Christmas came and Christmas went. Christmas that year was heaven sent. And my daddy put on his rubber boots and paced the floor waiting for the thaw. Back home in Dias, Arkansas.
Christmas as I Knew It by Johnny Cash, recorded in 1970 at Nashville's Ryman Auditorium during rehearsals for Cash's television show. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Happy Holidays.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the new Christmas album from the jazz vocal group New York Voices.
When I see you smile at me, I hear a haunting melody, and I surrender to the tender thrill it brings. A holiday for strings, sweet music all around me.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Listen this afternoon from 1 to 3 to 91.3 FM.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Crosses. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. I also want to say thank you to all of our listeners for their support last week with our short fundraiser. Thanks to all of our listeners who called in or pledged online with their financial contributions. And thanks to the local restaurants that kept us fed. And thanks to our fabulous phone volunteers who came in very early and stayed into the evening to help us take those pledges. So thanks to everyone all around. I will be back tomorrow along with my co-host Kyle Kellums for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.